You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Thank you for choosing our podcast. Our sponsors make it possible for us to keep bringing you new episodes. Please support them as they have some great deals just for you, our listeners. If you prefer to listen to ad-free content, simply find us on Patreon, where plans start as little as $2 a month. 25% of these proceeds are donated to the DOE Network, working to bring closure to international cold cases. For more information, follow the link in the show notes. Our cases deal with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. In a county-owned section of the leafy Georgetown Cemetery was a single grave standing alone. The headstone simply read, "Tent Girl." A police sketch of the unidentified young homicide victim, as well as details about her height, the color of her hair, and the date of her discovery did not make up for the fact that she had no name, and her family did not know about her demise. A local man, Wilbur Riddle, discovered the body tied up in a canvas 30 miles north of Georgetown in May of 1968. The body was transported to Lexington for an autopsy, but the examiner could not determine her identity. A Kentucky Post and Time Star report gave her the name Tent Girl. She became part of local history and would remain unidentified for another 30 years. On the 17th of May, 1968, well digger Wilbur Riddle was walking around a grassy hill on Route 25 near Georgetown, Kentucky. He was gathering glass insulators that had fallen down from telephone poles when he made a strange discovery. The first thing that caught his attention was a pungent smell. He followed the odor and came upon a green tent canvas rolled up around something lying on a flat rock. When Wilbur prodded it with his foot, so we could see what was inside, the tent rolled downhill. Intrigued, Wilbur followed and made the grisly discovery of human remains rolled up inside. The body was that of a young woman. Wilbur immediately realized what needed to be done and made his way to the nearest gas station from where he called police to come to the scene. They cut open the tarpaulin and revealed the badly decomposed body of a young white girl. An autopsy ruled the cause of death as homicide. The coroner was unable to determine how the victim was killed. Dr. Frank Cleveland, an expert who was brought in to help the identification process, noted, "I could find no trace of poison or toxic material in the girl's body. There was a slight discoloration of her skull, but the autopsy shows no definite cause of death." Detective Edward Cornett told the press what law enforcement theorized had happened to Tent Girl. "We think the girl was rendered unconscious by a blow to the head, then tied up in the bag to die a slow death by asphyxiation." Her death must have been one of unimaginable agony, trapped inside the rolled-up canvas of a tent, trying to get out, but being unable to move. When she was first found, her hand was clenched, like she had tried to claw her way out. Sadly, without the victim's identity, investigators did not have much to go on to solve the case. A police artist composed a picture showing what the victim must have looked like in life. In the summer of 1968, the mother of 15-year-old Doris Dittmar of Maryland reached out to authorities, wondering if the remains could belong to her missing daughter. Some elements did not match up with the evidence they had, and police were skeptical. Fortunately for Doris's family, she was found alive and well, living with her boyfriend in Pennsylvania. In a renewed appeal, Sheriff Bobby Vance told the American edition of the magazine Master Detective, "The case has bothered me more than anything that has happened in my 12 years as sheriff. If we could only identify the tent girl, I'm sure we would find whoever caused her death. Any reader in any state who has some idea of who she is, please contact us right away. It is quite possible that she was killed somewhere else and brought here." Still, despite many newspaper articles asking for the public's help, and no missing persons reports matching the description of the victim, the case went cold. After 3 years, the police had still not been able to identify the body. No suspects had been named, and police were skeptical of ever solving the case. It was decided that burying their Jane Doe, who had been dubbed Tent Girl, was the only respectful thing left to do. She was laid to rest in the Georgetown Cemetery. A local company donated a headstone with an engraving of the police sketch of the girl and bearing this inscription. Tent Girl, found May 17, 1968, on U.S. Highway 25 North. Died about April 26 to May 3, 1968. Age, about 16 to 19 years. Height, 5 feet, 1 inch. Weight, 110 to 115 pounds. Reddish brown hair. Unidentified. And that seemed to be the tragic ending of an unsolved mystery. That is, until many years later when Lori, the daughter of Wilbur Riddle, who had discovered Tent Girl, told the story to a school friend. This friend, who would later be her husband, is Todd Matthews. And he is here with us on the line today, all the way from Livingston, Tennessee. Hey Todd, it's great to have you on the Evidence Locker today. We've been exploring the case of Tent Girl on the podcast, and we're right up to the part where you learned about her for the first time. Would you care to share your story with us?
Happy to. Oh, wow. It was October of 1987. I saw three girls that were from Northern Kentucky walk into my school here in Livingston, Tennessee. And my best friend was sitting beside me. And it wasn't, I don't know how to describe. I recognized Lori. Lori just appeared to be somebody that I knew. And I told my best friend, I said, that's the girl I'm going to marry. And I thought, I don't even know why I said that. I have no idea why I even said that. But the rest of the day is trying to figure out, okay, who is she? Why are they here? And how will I get a chance to talk to her? Because obviously there's something. You know, we might have seen each other in the hall a few times after that. You know, the look in passing, obviously. So she ended up in my study hall. Now, my study hall, at the end of the day, was not the traditional study hall. We did not study. We played cards. We sat at tables. We told stories. It was Halloween, so we were normally telling ghost stories. And, you know, Lori came in, sat down fairly close to me, and she said, I guess we need to talk. We both knew that there was something to talk about. And then she started telling me the story of the Tent Girl, and it too sounded familiar. It's like, wait a minute. I've heard this story before. So I'm trying to figure out, did I see it on Unsolved Mysteries? Did I read about it somewhere? Where could I possibly have heard this story? I was 17 and she was 16. Didn't exactly have a long life to draw back upon from that. So it was, I was a senior and she was a junior. So we didn't really have a lot of time to have picked up a story like this. So obviously it had to be the first time I heard it. Ultimately, it gave me the opportunity to take her home from school, and her dad showed me the magazine, the Master Detective, but he gave me more detail. Now that Master Detective magazine really added a lot of sparkle to it. You know, they embellished it a great deal. Without even interviewing him, you know, they changed the names of the people. Some of the people in it that they didn't interview directly. And, you know, his name was changed in it. So he pointed all of that out. Early estimates was she was a child, teenage. He said, I don't believe that it was a child. He said, that was a woman. She was just small. She was just a small woman. He said, I saw her body. He said, that was a grown woman. She had well-developed breasts. Her fingernails had been painted. He said, I just don't see that as a child. So, and I went with that. You know, there was a diaper found in the bag with her. So I'm thinking that if it was a child, possibly somebody would have already come forward with needing her. My theory was she was older and had a child of her own. So that's the person I was looking for. I wasn't looking for a missing teenager. I was looking for a missing young adult with possibly a child. So that was the route that I took. Immediately after that, we're going into my senior year, deep into it, just discovering all the things with Tent Girl and Lori's, her family was actually going to visit Kentucky, and she stayed behind with us that one night because it's my graduation night. And she did that, and their house burned that night. And her dad says, we're going back to Kentucky, you know, and well, what about her? And he says, no, if another year and she can come back. That was not acceptable. So we weren't going to do that. And ultimately my dad intervened and somehow talked him into it. I don't know what he said or did to him to make him do it, but they took a walk around the yard, never really explained what was said. They came back and Wilbur said, we're going to go see the county attorney and get you guardianship. And she can stay here and finish school. So that's what we did. I don't think they really wanted to, but I think it made more sense. He had seven other children and no house, and they were going to have to go back and try to refind a way. Well, at least one of them was going to be taken care of. So we began life. We got married earlier. I just turned 18 and she was still 17, and we got married in July. And then ever since, you know, we started making our home. Dent Girl was always a story that was in the back of my mind, something that I've always thought about. We talked about, I think she got a little tired of me talking about it because I think she believed that I thought I would solve the case, but I don't think she thought it was possible. So I think she believed in my desire and wish to do so, but I think she thought it was just like, there's not going to be anything left. And I think it hurt her when she thought I was spending too much time doing something that was an effort, you know, futility. It just wasn't going to happen. And I think she thought it was a little unhealthy because it was like, you keep going back to it. When I would stop working on the case, when you get a little frustrated and you think, you know what, I've just got to put this aside. Yep, there would be nightmares. There was just all types of things that made me feel like I must return back and see what I can do. A needle in a haystack. Missing and unidentified was bigger than my 18-year-old mind understood at the time. I didn't realize the magnitude of the problem. I had no idea. The likelihood of finding her was very, very remote. So I built a 10-girl website, gather, sort, present, and somehow explain things differently. Like, I feel like this could be an older person, not a child. So I broaden the scope a little bit. And that's the same method we follow with Doe Network now. We gather, sort, present, and hope that somebody responds. But nobody responded to my website. I built it, and I thought, they will come. And they did not. They did not come. So it was a matter of going back again, a deep dive off into the internet, trying to find, and it was a different internet back in, like, between the, you know, the early 90s and mid 90s. It's not the same. And a lot of kids today wouldn't understand that it was antique in comparison to what you're seeing today. Going through message board after message board, searching every term. There wasn't even a Google. It was like different, tinier search engines. I looked up missing sister, missing mother, missing daughter, anything that I could put into a search engine. And one day it brought up a website called Crane and Hibbs.
In 1998, after years of researching the Tent Girl case, Todd Matthews was doing an online search, scrolling through a missing person's website, when all his efforts finally paid off. He discovered a post by Rosemary Westbrook, Bobby Ann's younger sister, that said, "My sister Barbara has been missing from our family since the latter part of 1967. She has brown hair, brown eyes, is about 5'2" tall, and was last seen in the Lexington, Kentucky area. If you have any information, please contact me at the address posted."
I had now to reach out to her and tell her, "Your sister is an urban legend in Kentucky." How do you do that? Luckily, I had that website that I built that put all the data in. It's just like, you know, I'm not going to try to explain this to you. Look at this, and we'll talk.
Todd's gut instinct told him that this could be the break he had been looking for years. By that time, his website about Tent Girl was well populated with information, and he emailed Rosemary the details. Rosemary also believed that the information matched her missing sister.
And she saw everything that I put together, and it made sense to her. And we talked on the telephone, exchanged photographs and just other things that I'd scanned, you know, that I might not have had on the website yet. Just every detail, conversations that I had. She said, "What's next?" And I said, "I guess there'll probably be some type of DNA comparison." And I called the Scott County Sheriff, or my sister-in-law did, and asked him to call me. He called and we talked about the weather and, you know, just all kinds of things in a circle until he said, "Well, now, the reason I called you back is because your father-in-law, a Scott County native, actually found that body. And since you're family, I'm going to give you the courtesy. Tell me what you think you found." And I started describing what I had, and I think he changed his mind quite quickly after that. And then I said, "We have all the data. Rosemary Westbrook is here ready to transmit photographs, mail them to you, come up for a visit. Whatever we have to do, we have to figure out if this is her," which I knew in my heart it was her. I knew when I read that name, that was her.
Rosemary was able to confirm that, like Tent Girl, her sister had a distinctive gap between her two front teeth. However, there were certain inconsistencies. Police were under the impression that Tent Girl was about 16 to 19 years old, and that she had died between April and May of 1968. Rosemary's sister was 24 and was believed to have vanished at the end of 1967. However, after 30 years, there finally was enough cause to warrant an exhumation. On the 2nd of March 1998, Tent Girl's remains were dug up and sent to a lab in Frankfort, Kentucky. An anthropologist for the state medical examiner's office, Dr. Emily Craig, was able to determine that Tent Girl was in fact older when she died, between 20 and 30 years old. Ultimately, Tent Girl's DNA was found to be a match to her siblings, the Hackman family.
I didn't know. If I'd known the odds, I might have been a little more skeptical of it, because now I realize there could be up to 40,000 unidentified bodies across the United States. And it's and I've worked on it very extensively. They never came like this before. You know, nothing ever resolved in this way again. And the way I did it, it's not even considered good practice now. Like, you wouldn't just contact a family member and say, I think this set of human remains could be your loved one. That's not the way that you do these, but it was the only way at that time was to connect with them and show them what I had and look at what they had. It was the first time the internet was used to do this sort of thing.
It was a big day for the Scott County Sheriff's Office when on April 16th, 1998, they were finally able to provide the identity of their victim. She was 24-year-old Barbara Ann Bobby Hackman. Bobby Ann's body was found in 1968. She likely died towards the end of 1967. But who was she? And how did she end up dead and discarded next to Highway 25? Barbara Ann, or Bobby, sometimes Bobby Ann, Hackman Taylor, was born on the 12th of September, 1943 in Illinois, and was one of seven children. Her father was sadly swept away in the St. Clair flood of 1957, along with Bobby Ann's little brother Harry, when their boat capsized in a small canal. As a single parent, Bobby's mother Louise was unable to care for her large family. Eventually, she made the heartbreaking decision of giving them up and asked the extended family to step in. She still saw her kids, and all of the Hackman siblings stayed in touch after they were separated. Bobby Ann met George Earl Taylor while babysitting his daughter. He claimed that his wife had left him and that he was raising little Bonnie all by himself. George was a truck driver for a traveling carnival, and his life seemed very exciting to Bobby Ann. Before long, she was head over heels in love, and the couple married before the carnival left town in August of 1963. Bobby Ann was 19 and George 24. As the newlyweds traveled along the East Coast, Bobby often called home, making collect calls and checking in with her family. A year after she left Illinois, Bobby called to say that she had a baby boy, George Earl Sonny Taylor. Later, she gave birth to a little girl, Dorothy Michelle, or Shelley. At one point, Bobby Ann and her young family lived in Florida for a while. Eventually, though, Bobby Ann fell out of contract with her relatives back in Illinois, or so they thought. By 1967, Bobby Ann and George Earl Taylor had a daughter together and lived in Lexington, Kentucky. Without informing her siblings, Bobby Ann had relocated to Kentucky from Florida. She worked as a curb waitress at the Quick Draw Drive-In, and George still worked at the carnival. She was last known to have been in Lexington, about 15 miles from Georgetown, where her body would eventually lay, unidentified for 30 years. When it was announced that Tent Girl was in fact Bobby Ann, three of her sisters were still alive: Rosemary Westbrook of Arkansas, Jan Daigle of California, and Marie Copeland of Maine. Bobby Ann's daughter Shelley was traced to Ohio, where her father's family had lived. She had married and had children of her own by the time her mother was identified. Sadly, Bobby Ann's son Sonny was killed by a drunk driver in 1984 when he was only 19 years old. Bobby Ann's husband George passed away from cancer in October 1987. He always claimed that Barbara had left him for another man and said that he hadn't seen her in years. He never reported her missing, which attributed to the fact that it took so long for her remains to be identified. Bobby Ann's stepdaughter, Bonnie, and her daughter Shelley recalled that George left them with his parents in 1967, claiming that Bobby Ann had left him and the kids. George carried on his vagrant life of working for traveling carnivals and driving trucks, and the children were raised by three different families, relatives of George's, and were told that they were cousins. After Sonny was killed, the family told Bonnie and Shelley that they were actually half-sisters. So when George was on his deathbed, they begged him for information about their birth mothers. All he told Bonnie was that her family was in Florida, and Shelley learned about her family in Illinois. Shelley managed to establish contact with Bobby Ann's siblings, and everyone grew concerned when they learned Bobby Ann had abandoned her children. This was not the type of person she was. She had many young siblings and knew how to care for a family. There was no way she would have left her kids. Bonnie, who was just about 10 when Bobby Ann disappeared, recalled waking up one night in December 1967. She overheard an argument between George and Bobby Ann and some scuffling. The next morning, her beloved stepmother was gone, never to be seen again. She saw Bobby Ann's purse on the front seat of George's car, and when she asked him where Bobby Ann was, he said that she had left with another man. George took his three children to a man called the Colonel and left them with the man's wife, and George and the Colonel took off. The Colonel's wife bathed and fed them, and they fell asleep there. George carried his sleeping children into his station wagon and took them to Ohio. All of their lives changed forever that day. After leaving them, it was 2 years before he returned. George was never implicated in her disappearance at the time, though there are elements in the case that point to his guilt. In Deborah Halber's book, The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases, the author reveals that George Earl Taylor went AWOL from the U.S. Army in 1962, shortly before he married Bobby Ann. Also, besides Bonnie and his two children from his marriage to Bobby, George had fathered at least 10 other children with 9 women between 1958 and 1987. He was a con artist of sorts, who would take one child with him to a new city, play the forlorn single father, and then reel in his next victim. Bobby Ann's body was found along the route from Lexington, Kentucky to Ohio, a road frequently used by George Earl Taylor. The green tent canvas that became her shroud was the kind of material used to store carnival tents. If Bobby Ann had been identified when she was found by Wilbur Riddle 5 months later, chances are George would have had a lot to answer for. In the late 90s, Barbara's family decided to have her remains reinterred in the Georgetown Cemetery, where she had been laid to rest back in 1967. The original headstone was put back in place with an additional inscription bearing her name, date of birth, and approximate date of death, erasing her anonymity by stating that she was a loving mother, grandmother, and sister. Significantly, the name on the headstone is Barbara Ann Hackman, and there is no mention of her married name, Taylor, strongly implying that the family believes her husband, George Earl Taylor, to have been responsible for her demise. In the end, this is a story about family. Wilbur Riddle discovered Barbara's body, and his son-in-law finally solved the mystery of her identity. Wilbur praised Todd's efforts, saying, "He has put in more than 1,000 hours on this case. There's no law enforcement office that worked harder on any case than he did on this one." And thanks to this family's persistence and tenacity, thousands of other families can find closure, knowing the fate of their loved ones and lay them to rest, honoring their memories. Hey Todd, it's great to have you on the Evidence Locker today. What urged you to start the investigation? Was it a hobby that gradually grew into an obsession?
I think it was organically. I always liked ghost stories. But again, I didn't realize how young I was until I had children that age. It changed a lot of things in a lot of people's lives, mostly mine, I think, more than anybody, because it's every day now. Every day since I heard the name Tent Girl, my life has drastically been very different. So she's just become a part of who I am now, I think.
It is interesting to me because, you know, on the record, you're a pioneer. Just falling into Tent Girl prior to the internet.
This is before cyber units, you know, and then after that, law enforcement were contacting me with, "Hey, we have another Jane Doe. We have this John Doe. We have this missing person. Could you help us build a website? Could you put it in social media?" And it's like, "Oh, okay, I guess I will." And that's when I started to send other volunteers. I had in mind to build a website called Lost and Found for Kentucky and possibly beyond, you know, and I'm thinking I've got to build it. I've got to gather. So everybody's sending me all these photographs and things and other people. I started finding other citizen sleuths after that, other people that had the desire to go online and try to match things up. So a lot of the pieces come from a lot of different people, but the dream of Lost and Found actually took reality in what we now know is the Doe Network. You know, it had to come together. I finally built a nonprofit section of Doe Network now so that people are always thinking, "We donate money. Can we contribute to it?" And for a while, it was like, no. Even with you guys, it was like, you know, you guys do offer support for us and we appreciate it. But at first, there was no mechanism to capture that. I was spending more time trying to figure out on a nonprofit how to get rid of a $3 donation, spending $50 worth of time. And it's like, it's just too hard for something, you know, it's not with NamUs, it's $7 million a year. So there's a lot of things. But I did learn some things during that time period. And then there was a way to do this giving with Four Givings website that offered us a way to collect it and keep it straight, you know, exactly where it comes from. I could apply it to the web fees and things like that, but it was there had to be a bigger picture. For a while, NAMIS had a victim services unit, and that was designed to help pay for certain things that regular funding didn't account for. So it would handle maybe the repatriation of remains, maybe pay for a tombstone, just something that was out of the regular, a specialized DNA test that wasn't available. Well, that disbanded all about the same time they just kind of dropped so much stuff that was going into it. It became just kind of a normal database. Well, we decided to create a justice services unit for Doe Network to help Infraction replace that effort. We can go back to what we were doing before they came along, like the Project Eden. That's our forensic art project.
And that's everyone deserves a name is Eden.
Everyone deserves a name. And it was a specialized creation of Doe Network that was for a reason. There was a need for forensic art and a professional set of volunteers, certified forensic artists that we knew that I was coming to know online. And it was like, you know what, we can do this. And it was extremely successful because there were artists coming and begging for pictures, you know, but you have to go and say, somebody has to want this artwork and commission it first, and then we can give it to them at no cost. Like, I'll do some of the legwork to get all the stuff organized. Somebody else does the artwork. And, you know, just do whatever has to be done to make it work. The case that the Project Eden was based on was one from here in Tennessee, Campbell County. Murder victim, bullet hole through the head. I literally went and picked up her skull in a duffel bag, brought it back here, shipped it to a forensic artist. He brought it back to me. He was in North Carolina, South Carolina, and he and I met. And he brought me the clay bust, the clay reconstruction. So I had it. I had it on Good Morning America. Now, this is 2001. Had it everywhere I could get the picture put out there, and still nothing. And only recently, it's been within this year, after all of those years, I finally got to make that phone call to that forensic artist, which is now retired. And I said, I told you one day I would call you and tell you that we had a name. And here it is. I mean, 20 years later than I expected, but at least it is. I mean, I could still call and tell him. And just recently, there's been some news articles about it, just recently really been released. So I finally got to show him her face. And that was an amazing thing. That was me giving him back something. You know, he generated something. We called her Sally, for lack of a better name. We just had to have a name for her, you know, just something. But if we referenced Sally, we were talking about our girl. And then now to find out who she is, and I want to find out more about her. She was from Ohio. Really don't know exactly how she got here, or what she was doing here, or how she came to find herself murdered. But that's something I want to find out. But that name and that face, that phone call back, that promise I made 20 years earlier, and you got to fulfill that promise and call that artist and said, I told you I'd call you one day when I had the name. And that's today.
We here at Evidence Locker donate a percentage of the income we make on Patreon to the Doe Network every month. But let's say our listeners would like to make a once-off donation or would like to support you on an ongoing basis. How would they go about doing that, Todd? And what would the money be used for?
Okay, our Justice Services Unit, that money is going to be used for whatever forensic needs are out there, even maybe some database construction, just anything that can help build this project. And we will always be very transparent. You have to have enough money to actually do something with first, but it's very viewable on our website. If you go to donetwork.org, you can look at the donate place, your spot on it. And again, we're not saying we're asking for donations. We're telling people that they come to us and ask, can we donate? So we gave a mechanism and we're going to show you what we're going to do with it. But we don't want to be somebody that feels like we're constantly begging for money. And I don't even know what's going to happen with it yet. You know, it's going to go to a good cause, no doubt.
Well, you know what? We're still happy to be able to represent that cause for you guys. It's the one thing we've chosen to champion as Evidence Locker. And
it's a worthy cause to support. It makes unsolved mysteries feel solvable. And thanks to your persistence, countless families have found the closure they so desperately needed. Thanks for your time today, Todd, and we really look forward to staying in touch with you. Thanks so much.
Well, you too, and if I can do anything else for you guys, and we appreciate every drop you put in the bucket.
If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit us on social media to see more about today's case. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also check out our channel on YouTube. If you like what we do here at Evidence Locker, subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now, and kindly leave a 5-star review. This was the Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.